Wow. Thank you for that, Stephen. That was wonderful. I got a bunch of questions and more coming. Assuming the U.S. and Iran could come together on Iraq and Syria, what do you see as a possible blowback or positive outcome?
This is something I've been advocating for years. I feel the United States and Iran have long-term strategic interests in common. The number one strategic existential threat to Iran is jihadism, the Al-Qaeda ideology. They are in a terror. They hate Al-Qaeda more than we do, and let me tell you, Al-Qaeda returns that hatred. They want to kill all Shiites. It's an existential threat for Iran, and they warned us about this over and over. Finally, I hope that we can learn this lesson. We have some partners in the Middle East whose long-term strategic interests clash with ours. Let's face it, what's good for Saudi Arabia in the long run is bad for us. And what's good for us, it's bad for them. We should accept this. Iran, it's different. What's good for Iran in the long run will be good for us. The only reason we haven't been willing to embrace this geopolitical fact has to do with emotion. We're still angry at them. And that anger goes all the way back to the hostage crisis. Emotion is always the enemy of wise statesmanship. And no country in the world shows that more clearly than Iran from the American perspective.
If we were to read older biographies of Foster and Allen Dulles, would they be more respectful than yours?
There was a spate of biographies of the Dulles brothers when they, soon after they left public office, they were quite fawning. More recently, there have been some better studies of them, but in this century, I think there hasn't been any book about them. Really, I feel like they were almost forgotten by most Americans. And in fact, I used to hate the idea that they'd named that airport after them. Now I'm glad, because otherwise, we wouldn't remember that name at all. In fact, when I was writing this book, people, my friends, would say to me, so, what are you writing about? I'd say, I'm writing a book about Dulles. They'd say, the airport? So my answer to that question is that previous biographies could not have done what my biography does because so much of the information that I'm using wasn't available to a previous generation. Only now are we able to piece the parts together and see the big picture. That wasn't possible in a previous generation.
Is there a difference between the Dulleses and, or where do they fit in the spectrum of today's neocons, the Cheneys of the world?
I think that in many ways, Foster Dulles was a predecessor for the modern neocon movement. And actually, if you look through Paul Nitze, you can actually trace the lineage through Team B. Those of you who followed all these backs and forths of the Project for a New American Century, all of this is part of a stream. I think that when I read in my New York Times about this guy named Kagan who wants us to go out and intervene everywhere in the world, it sounds just like Foster Dulles, that we haven't learned anything. We're still thinking, you know, we just didn't stay there long enough. Just give us another couple of years in Iraq. 14 billion. Can we spend 14 and a half billion? That'll do the trick. We're still caught up in this mindset that it's not our approach that's wrong. It's just that we just have gotten a few of the tactics wrong. And if we just keep trying, we're going to get it right.
We've got four questions here about Eisenhower. Eisenhower comes across as kind of a villain in this. We've been used to thinking of Eisenhower as a kindly father figure, but...
I don't mention that in my speech because it's always one of the first questions. Usually it's the first question. What about Eisenhower? Where was he in all of this? And that is actually a fascinating piece of all this. So I entered this project still uncertain about which of these various interpretations to believe. The Dulles brothers bamboozled Eisenhower, they deceived him, or they tricked him, or he wasn't smart enough, or did he know everything? I later concluded in the end that the latter was true, that actually Allen Dulles and Foster Dulles kept Eisenhower totally informed of what they were doing. He knew everything. Every single day, at the end of the day, unless one of them was in another country, Foster Dulles would go over to the White House around 6 o'clock and have a couple of drinks with Eisenhower, and they would talk about the world. And Foster would then be in touch with his brother many times a day, and they would have lunch. So that's how they, that was the chain of command. Now, Eisenhower was a great believer in covert action and clandestine regime change operations. Why? Well, we don't know for sure because he never admitted that there were covert operations, so he never explained why he supported them. But looking back, I think we can come up with a few guesses. One is that although nobody knew it at the time, covert action played an important role in winning World War II, including the breaking of the Nazi codes and their various other operations. Eisenhower would, of course, have been aware of all of these as the American, as the United Commander. So maybe he came away from World War II with an appreciation for covert action. And I think there's another reason. Eisenhower would have seen covert action as a kind of a peace project. Here was a guy that had to send kids off to die by the thousands. This must have weighed on him. And now somebody comes to him and says, I can get rid of that government over there, and like 100 people will die. And none of them will be Americans, and it will cost you like $500,000. He would have thought this was fantastic. He's saving huge lives. He's preventing wars. Again, he shared the blind spot of the Dulles brothers in having no concept, no imagination of what might happen decades ahead after operations are launched that seem successful at the time. Eisenhower, in the summer of 1959, in the summer of 1960, also did two things, or he did one thing twice that, as far as we know, no other president has ever done, which is to order the assassination of a foreign leader. He ordered the assassination of Castro, and he ordered the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. Only one was successful, of course. But the message I took away from this study is that Eisenhower was a pretty tough guy behind that smile.
During World War, I don't know if this is true or just apocryphal, during World War II, Alan Dulles spent some time in Bern and received a German general. Do you know anything about that? Is that true?
Yeah. Alan Dulles was posted as an intelligence agent in Bern, Switzerland, during both wars, First World War, Second World War. During the Second World War, yes, he was involved in a project that actually some later historians have pointed to as something that helped foment the Cold War at the beginning, when U.S. and Russia were still putative allies in Europe. It was Allen's idea that he wanted to try to get the Nazi generals in Italy and Austria, that was the United Command, to surrender, since it was clear that Berlin was collapsing. And he did arrange this. He got them to surrender about a week early. And the general with whom he worked was the number two man in the SS, under Himmler, and was also, among other things, responsible for the liquidation of the Warsaw Ghetto. So he has hundreds, and was later brought to trial as a war criminal. Alan Dulles helped him get off, helped him get jobs, and remained faithful to this number two man in the SS his whole life. I can't get past the Bern episode, though, without telling one more story, because this was one of Alan's favorites. We know this story because he used to tell it himself. This was during the First World War. Alan was quite a playboy, as I told you. And it was a Friday afternoon. He had a big date for the weekend. According to one biographer, I'm just quoting, it was with two spectacularly buxom Swiss sisters who had agreed to spend the weekend with him at an inn. So the phone rang as he was leaving. And it was another one of these thickly accented exiles with whom Alan Dulles was dealing every day. And the guy said, I have a message for America. I must speak with America. We must speak right now. So Alan said, fine, you got a message for America? First thing Monday morning, you can come in and tell it to me. The guy said, no, it can't be Monday morning. It has to be now. I got to come now. And they went back, and he kept saying, well, I can't be now because I'm out of here. And they went back and forth, and Alan tells the story in quite a full way. And Monday comes, the guy doesn't call back. Nothing ever happened. And it wasn't until years later that he figured out who it was. It was Lenin. Lenin had a message for America. And the reason he didn't call back was the next day on that Saturday, he went on the sealed train to the Finland station and went back to St. Petersburg to change the course of world history. What was the message? What did he want to tell America? As Alan said, we'll never know.
Should I do it, maybe, was the message. Yeah. Was there a relationship between the Dulles brothers and Senator McCarthy?
The relationship between the Dulles brothers and Joe McCarthy was very interesting because the relationships were quite different. They responded to McCarthy in different ways. Foster Dulles always wanted to accommodate Joe McCarthy. He had this belief, which he had taken from his friendship with Woodrow Wilson, that secretaries of state always have to deal closely with powerful members of Congress. So Foster Dulles actually hired one of Joe McCarthy's investigators, a former FBI agent who kept a picture of McCarthy on his desk, as the State Department security officer. And that started all these security probes, loyalty checks, and hundreds of people were fired from the State Department during this period as a result of what was considered to be uncertain loyalty. So Foster Dulles knuckled under to McCarthy and allowed McCarthy essentially to run the personnel office of the State Department, which was devastating. It's what led us, for example, to have nobody in the State Department who knew anything about China and could tell us, you know, China and Vietnam, they're not really allies. We didn't find that out until way too late. But we didn't have any expertise because all those people had been fired in the McCarthy purges that Foster Dulles promoted. Allen was different. Allen did not have pressure mounting on him bit by bit. It all came on one day. He got a phone call one day from Roy Cohn, the chief investigator for McCarthy's committee. And Roy Cohn said to him, you've got a person on your staff who has contributed $300 to the Alger Hiss Defense Fund. We want that person down here to testify. So Allen immediately sent him out of town. Actually came back home to Manchester by the Sea. And he went up to Capitol Hill to see McCarthy and the other Republicans on the committee. And he told them, you're not going to get any testimony from people in the agency. It's too sensitive. You've got to make an exception for the CIA. And as soon as he got back to his office, he called Vice President Nixon, and he asked Nixon, call Joe McCarthy for me and tell him he's got to let up on the pressure on the CIA. And that happened. After that, McCarthy never bothered the CIA. And so in one way, it was a success. But later on, I came to think that in a way, it was negative because it reinforced the view in Washington that the CIA was something special and the CIA was something you should never touch.
I've got 14 more questions that we're not going to get to. I'm going to send you home with homework, Stephen.
Usually it's the other way around. I send my students home that way.
I will end with this one. Suppose they were here in the audience and we handed them a mic, John Foster and Allen. What would they have to say about not just what you said here, but the book?
That's a great question, and I've thought about that. I think I can imagine what their answer would be. And I think it's a little bit similar to what Henry Kissinger would say if I produced a book that talked about, look what happened in Chile, look what happened in Indonesia, look what Cambodia and all. I'm producing a book about a number of the operations that the Dulles brothers carried out. What they would say is, why are you focusing on these meaningless little places like Indonesia and Congo? What about Europe? The Cold War was the main thing going on. We prevented a nuclear war. We kept Europe safe. All that other stuff was just footnotes. Those are details. That was the way they saw the world. You know, Henry Kissinger famously said, I know nothing about, nor am I interested in, the world south of the Pyrenees. The Dulles brothers were very much like this. Don't forget that the generation that they came from thought of Europe as being essentially the world. They were schooled in diplomacy. They knew about the history of diplomacy, but what did they know? What they really knew was the history of diplomacy in Europe. There you have certain paradigms that are always replaying themselves. Big powers that use smaller powers as their cat's paws, shifting alliances. But the huge issue that was roiling the entire developing world in that time, which was the fervent desire of people in poor countries to control their own resources, was never an issue in Europe. That's not part of European history. They would not have even focused on this as a realistic basis for policy. So they would have said, I think in their critique of my book, that I ignored their huge achievement, which was preventing a nuclear war and keeping Europe safe, and instead focused on meaningless episodes that have been blown way out of proportion by history. Now, reading today's newspapers, I think I'd have a good counter-argument to their complaint.
Stephen, I am going to send you back with homework. Go home, write another great book, and come back and tell us about it, please. Stephen Kinzer.
Thank you all.